From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Tess Vigeland, in for Arun Roth. In this episode, we go into the California wilderness where one man lost his way. After days spent stranded and hungry, he came up with a desperate plan.
I actually had a little topographical map just around the lake, and by the time I realized I was lost, I was actually off my map.
Plus, part-time workers are a growing feature of the economic recovery.
There's been days where I leave the house Sunday morning to go to one job, and I usually don't get back home till maybe Monday evening.
And hitmaker Bruce Hornsby strays from his piano-infused pop to pursue an obsession with classical piano, and he is even avoiding the pop hits in that catalog, too.
Every time she runs away.
That's all on this podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. West Africa continues to deal with the Ebola epidemic that has so far claimed almost 1,500 lives. Today, Ivory Coast closed its land borders with the affected countries of Liberia and Guinea in an attempt to contain the outbreak. The strain of the epidemic is showing. Last week, Liberian soldiers opened fire when a riot broke out in the quarantined neighborhood of West Point. Photographer and reporter Tommy Trenchard was there. One of his photos is of a young man, Shaki Kamara, lying in the street with his leg badly wounded. Tommy Trenchard joins me now from the Liberian capital of Monrovia. Hi, Tommy.
Hi there.
I want to talk about that photo of Shaki Kamara. You were with him shortly after he was shot. Tell us about who he was and what happened to him.
Well, Shaki was a 15-year-old resident of West Point. Little else is known about him, though his mother called into a local radio station to say that he'd just been sent out to buy some tea and bread. He was shot in the legs by the Liberian security forces. And for almost half an hour, he was lying there in the road between the police and the protesters. People just didn't seem to know how to get him an ambulance, which really underscores the problems Liberia's health service has had, I mean, even before this Ebola outbreak. And he later died in Redemption Hospital.
So he died of a gunshot wound to the leg?
Yes, well, the hospital director is being coy about the specific cause of death, but it seems very unlikely that anything else could have caused an injury of that nature. We have also heard that President Sirleaf has said there should be no more lethal force used by the security forces here. So that is seen as a sign of progress.
Tommy, this neighborhood, West Point, is home to more than 50,000 people, and it's still under quarantine, meaning no one can leave or enter. How are people there getting by?
Well, I think they've been hit hard by this quarantine. I mean, it was imposed overnight with no warning. A lot of people simply lost their livelihoods overnight. A lot of them were traders and taxi drivers who used to work in other parts of Monrovia. I think the residents are angry at the situation. A lot of them deny that there is even Ebola in West Point, and they feel this is an embarrassment to them and their community.
You mentioned that the president has ordered government forces no longer to fire on citizens, but aside from that, since the riot, how has the community been interacting with the government, with forces there? Has there been any more unrest?
Well, some community leaders we hear have actually requested an increased police presence, though that may not reflect the views of many residents there. The community was already disenfranchised within Monrovia. I think this latest incident will simply have exacerbated that.
Tommy Trenchard is a photographer and reporter traveling with the NPR team in Monrovia, Liberia. You can see his photos at our website, npr.org. Tommy, thank you and stay safe.
Thank you.
Police in Ferguson, Missouri are bracing for the possibility of a large protest there tonight as the community outside of St. Louis marks 2 weeks since a white police officer shot and killed unarmed black teenager Michael Brown. The last 3 nights have been relatively quiet and peaceful with smaller demonstrations following several nights of unrest in the wake of the shooting. In the predominantly African-American neighborhood where the most violent protests have taken place, NPR's David Shaper reports on a generation gap between residents and how they view the protests.
Racial tensions have cooled considerably in Ferguson after nearly 10 days of loud, raucous, and sometimes violent protests, during which some agitators would throw rocks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails at police, who responded with rubber bullets, smoke bombs, and tear gas. Among those in the midst of the violent demonstrations last week was 20-year-old Marcus Mopkins of Ferguson.
Yeah, there was a couple of people shooting at the police. That's where they should have been.
You think they should have been?
Yeah. If you ask me, I would have shot the police myself.
Asked why, Mopkins says it's not just because of the shooting of Michael Brown, but what residents here say is a long pattern of police harassment of young black men and the aggressive police efforts to contain and disperse the protesters.
I'm fed up. I'm ready to cause damage myself.
That kind of frustration worries other residents of this mostly African-American part of Ferguson, who are anxious the protests could turn violent again any time.
Ron Reynolds, 57 years old. I work at Boeing, and our neighborhood is messed up right now.
Reynolds is standing in his driveway one recent night as a police helicopter hovers over the protesters a couple of blocks away.
We're residents here. Everything is going on. It reflects us. It reflects us.
Reynolds worries that some of the burned and looted businesses won't come back, and some homeowners might move out too. And Reynolds says by turning violent, the protesters' calls for justice might be lost.
I think differently about what's going on.
This is Reynolds' 36-year-old stepson, Charles Jolly.
I think it is a generation gap, and I understand the young people.
Jolly says some violent protesting in Ferguson is necessary.
I don't condone all of it, but you wouldn't be here if that wouldn't happen. It wouldn't get a lot of notoriety, and it'll probably just be swept under the rug.
I understand the way my son feel, and you can't blame them. That's their generation.
Again, 57-year-old Ron Reynolds.
Our generation is you try to be peaceful. Like Martin Luther King said, you turn the other cheek. But this generation ain't going to turn the other cheek. As simple as that. They're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. They're tired.
They've been harassed more than we have.
That's right.
They're harassed on a daily basis.
54-year-old Adrian Ellis is an electrician who lives across the street. He says he understands the frustrations of the young protesters, but Ellis worries that violent protesting helps perpetuate a stereotype of the black community being violent. And while the protests have chilled considerably, the three men all worry about the still simmering racial tensions beneath the surface of Ferguson, especially, Ron Reynolds says, if police officer Darren Wilson isn't charged in the shooting of Michael Brown.
You can bet Ferguson is going to burn.
A grand jury began hearing evidence in the case this week. David Shaper, NPR News, Ferguson, Missouri.
You're out in the wilderness, hiking deep through a remote forest, and suddenly you realize you're completely lost. You have no cell phone signal, no food. You have no idea where you are. That's what happened to Mike Vilhauer earlier this month. He was on a fishing trip in the Mokelumne Wilderness, 70 miles east of Sacramento, California, when what started as a weekend getaway turned into a fight for his life.
I was fishing on this lake. It was a small lake, and I was in a kayak. I'm the only one there. It was like 10:45 in the morning because I'd been there all day fishing and without success. And then I thought, you know what, I'm going to hurry up and go get some bait and come right back. And it ended up being 5 days and later that I actually got to see somebody.
And what were you looking for out in the woods?
Grasshoppers, actually. If everything else failed, get the local insects, and then the vast majority of times we'd catch fish. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to go and see if I can find some. And went up a ridge and was expecting to see the lake, and no lake. I actually had a little topographical map just around the lake, and by the time I realized I was lost, I was actually off my map.
Do you at some point start to feel panic creeping in?
I was actually more irritated with myself. It was getting windy and the storm front was coming in, and so I was looking for somewhere to get out of the wind, and then I found a big pine tree and just started pulling in needles, and then I saw some willow trees, and so I started cutting branches, and then basically just try to cover up. I was wet from going in and out of streams, so I stayed awake all night, as I did for the next four nights.
Mike, what were you surviving on? Did you have any food with you, any water? What did you do?
I had no food for 5 days, and then there's some streams running through these canyons that I was crossing to go up to the ridges, and so I would always go back down to the streams. I just kept drinking whenever I could find some water.
Rescue crews were out searching for you, and I know there was a time when a helicopter flew basically right overhead and they didn't spot you. But another day goes by, and by day five, you are still out there. Did you ever think to yourself, I'm not going to get out of here?
Saturday was my last attempt at trying to crest a mountain to look on the other side, and I didn't think the ridge was that high. And unfortunately, I'd get up to that ridge, and there'd be another ridge. And then there'd be another ridge and another ridge. And then I actually just laid down, and I, for a few minutes, I said, you know what, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I'm exhausted. I have no strength. And then about 5-10 minutes, and then I said, no, I'm not doing that here. I'm going back down to that damn water, and I'm going to stay there for as long as it takes till they find me.
You decide that you're going to write a giant message with cypress needles. Where did you do it? Was there a meadow or something where that was going to stand out to anyone who was looking for you from above?
I was at the edge of a cliff, and the gravel and the rock was very light, like a light tan. And there was one tree in the middle, and it was a cypress tree. I started doing a little hair cutting on the cypress tree and then sticking the branches into the ground on the side of this ridge with help, about 8 feet tall letters.
And this is what got you rescued?
Ultimately, they saw the help sign, yeah. They came by, and I was thinking they were going over the ridge, but they came back around. They had to see me. I mean, I'm getting up and waving my little shirt and yelling and screaming for, you know, 30, 40 seconds before I was exhausted, and then they'd come back around again. They were circling for the ground team.
And what was that like for you when you saw the first person come out of the woods?
It was actually a dog. Micah was the tracking dog. And right then behind her was that dog handler. And then I could look up, I mean, see the other ones coming down. They were all in orange. And so that was one hell of a relief.
Mike Vilhauer, stranded in the Northern California wilderness for 5 days. He is back home in Sacramento, still recovering, but getting back to normal. According to the Alpine County Sheriff's Department, 8 counties had search and rescue teams out looking for him. Next month, he'll meet with members of those search crews, including the El Dorado County's search and rescue team, which spotted his help message written in cypress needles, to thank them, and maybe to promise that they'll never have to do it again. From the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, it's All Things Considered. Arun Roth is away. I'm Tess Vigeland. The Great Recession officially ended in June of 2009, more than 5 years ago. Since then, the economy has created millions of jobs, but it's still not enough. Take a close look at employment figures, and you find that of all the people the government labels as full-time workers, 6 to 11% of those are only full-time because they're cobbling together two or more part-time jobs. And that's the focus of our cover story today. The federal government says Stephanie Green is a full-time worker. She lives in San Diego with her 4 children, aged 10 to 19. 2 years ago, she divorced from an abusive husband, but that left her temporarily without a roof over her head. She lived in shelters until she found a job with a company that runs parking garages.
And I just went in there and explained to them, like, this is my situation. You know, I'm currently homeless and I'm trying to get myself on my feet for me and my kids.
Initially, the parking company gave her full-time hours, but it cut the entire staff down to part-time last year, citing the cost of the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Now, Green works 3 jobs, the parking company plus 2 jobs in security, all of which provides barely enough to make ends meet.
I do have Section 8, which does help tremendously with my rent, but they also went up at the beginning of the year, and so I can barely pay, I can pay the rent, but it's the other bills that I have that I have to struggle with.
She attended a for-profit school that she says provided a worthless education, but left her with about $7,000 in debt. Her calendar is her lifeline.
There's been a couple of times where I have to go to one job in the morning, and I usually take my other uniforms in a backpack, change real quick, go to the other job right after. There's been days where I leave the house Sunday morning to go to one job, and I usually don't get back home till maybe Monday evening to see my kids.
Her older children provide childcare for the younger siblings. Douglas Hunter has one 16-year-old daughter and no one else to help care for her. He's 53, a widower, lives in Chicago, and after a long career on factory floors, has spent the last 5 years working part-time for $9 an hour at a local McDonald's.
Trying to take care of my daughter, provide for her, have a roof over her head, that means I bring in like $360 every 2 weeks. And the rent is $775, and so it's a bit of a struggle. It's a juggle every day, all day, you know, and it's rough.
Hunter tells us the McDonald's job gives him 30 hours a week, sometimes 20. He fills in the gaps with odd jobs when he can get them, but worries about not being home for his daughter when she's not in school. He scoffs at the notion that the economy is recovering.
I was scrapping and scraping and stressing. Before the recession, I was scrapping and scraping and stressing during the recession, and I'm still scrapping and scraping and stressing. Nothing has changed for me.
None of this is a surprise to economist Susan Lambert of the University of Chicago, who studies how part-time jobs are affecting the economy. I asked her how the federal government determines who is a part-time worker.
The Census Bureau, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, both ask people, how many hours do you usually work, or how many hours did you work last week? And if you say 35 or more, they classify you as being a full-time worker. Now, that doesn't mean that you have a full-time job, but that you're a full-time worker. If you report a number less than 35 hours, they ask you why. And people give a range of reasons. And only if they say, I'm working less than 35 hours because I couldn't find a full-time job or my employer cut my hours, are they classified as being what we call involuntary part-time. And in fact, in other studies, instead, what people are asked is a work hour preference. Would you like to continue to work the same hours for the same pay, more hours for more pay, fewer hours for less pay? And when people are asked that question, a much larger proportion of people say, I would like more hours for more pay.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what that part-time employment looks like now that maybe it didn't look like before, that there are new tactics that employers use to basically keep worker hours down?
So one of them is posting schedules with very little advance notice, just maybe a day or two in front of the work week. Changing schedules once posted, it makes it very difficult to arrange anything when you don't know when you're going to work. People will work different numbers of hours week to week, different days of the week, different shifts. And so employers are turning to employees to fill in for short time slots during peak demand. And if they don't use you, they'll send you home early. They have people waiting on call more often so that you wait to call in to see if you're going to work that day. So fluctuating, unpredictable hours. And then also what you mentioned before, the issue of a lot of people aren't getting enough hours. Hmm. So even when they're that flexible and they're that available, they are really scrambling to get enough hours to earn a decent living.
What does all this mean for the overall economy? When you have all these people working part-time jobs with weird hours and no predictability, does that have a greater impact?
On the one hand, a lot of people are saying that any job is better than no job. And if we don't have these part-time jobs and we concentrate the hours on a smaller percentage of workers, well, then we'll have higher rates of unemployment. On the other hand, and I tend to be in this other camp, is that I think that, and there is evidence to support, that the way the economy has really grown is by a strong middle class. that when we have a middle class who can afford goods, durable goods, and who are living beyond just trying to make the rent and feed their family, that that group of workers is what grows the economy in the United States.
Susan Lambert of the University of Chicago. And Stephanie Green, the mother of four we heard from earlier, well, she's hoping to enroll in an EMT class this fall, adding to the calendar that already features three jobs.
Oh, yeah, so I'll find some way to do it, and I will go ahead and make it work. You know, I mean, I've struggled a lot, but it's like, you know, just keep my faith up and, you know, everything will work itself out.
As goes Stephanie Green, perhaps goes the U.S. economy. If you've just tuned in, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Tess Vigeland. If you're ready for some football, well, NFL season is just a couple of weekends away, and with it, the new version of Madden. Each year, the latest edition of the only official NFL video game tries to be more and more realistic, whether it's the commentary or the gameplay, or even the touchdown dances. But the game has never displayed players' real-life tattoos until now. NPR's Becky Sullivan explains.
Sumit Sarkar has been playing Madden for more than 20 years. Now he's a reporter for the gaming website Polygon. He says the franchise has made realistic visuals a huge priority.
NFL superstars definitely look like their real-life counterparts would. I mean, you'd be able to look at their face in the game and go, oh man, that's Eli Manning.
But tattoos have long been an exception. Some old versions had generic tattoos, Sarkar says, but no player has ever had their real ink appear in the game until now.
And here is quarterback Colin Kaepernick. And just now,
in real life, Colin Kaepernick, the young starting quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, is covered in tattoos. His chest, his back, his arms. In the newest Madden, the computerized Kaepernick sticks out like a sore thumb in the sea of bare arms along the line of scrimmage, because he is the only character in the game displaying his real-life tattoos. Tim Bradley is an intellectual property attorney. I asked him why some video game makers have been so cautious. He explained to me that copyright law is actually very friendly to tattoo artists. All they have to do to get the protection of the law is use a, quote, modicum of creativity in the design and put it on a, quote, tangible medium.
So that could be paper or film or what have you. And you automatically own the copyrights in that.
With tattoos, the medium is the person they've tattooed. But it's tricky. While the artists definitely own the copyright to their design,
the recipient certainly owns their body, so they own the copy of your work. And so the thorny question comes in about what happens when additional copies are made.
Meaning a recreation of the tattoo, like, say, a video game version of it. Or more famously, this bit from the movie The Hangover Part 2.
Oh my God!
The guys have just woken up from their blackout night.
This is a real tattoo!
In a nod to Mike Tyson's role in the first Hangover movie, Ed Helms' uptight dentist character wakes up to find his own face now has a copy of Tyson's famous and distinctive facial tattoo. But the tattoo artist was never asked for permission for his work to appear on someone else's face. So he sued, and Warner Brothers settled. No surprise, the NFL Players Association started advising players to acquire the rights to their tattoos, especially players like Colin Kaepernick, whose real tattoos have become a signature part of his on-field persona.
And especially the one that, you know, the one when he makes that touchdown, he just goes for that bicep and kiss that, you know?
This is Nez Andrian. He's the artist who made the tattoos on Kaepernick's bicep. He runs a tattoo shop in Reno called Endless Ink. He says business has been booming since Kaepernick started doing all those bicep kisses on national TV. Andrian has gotten used to seeing his designs everywhere that Kaepernick and his famous body art appear. Newspapers, magazine covers. It was no surprise to see the tattoos star in a Yahoo fantasy football commercial.
Oh, hey, Colin Kaepernick here.
In the commercial, Kaepernick is shirtless, sitting in a tattoo parlor, surrounded by three tattoo artists working away with their needles. Nez Andrian's work on Kaepernick's chest and arms is on full display.
Wow, this says I'm the fantasy QB of the future. Let's write that in somewhere.
With lawsuits over tattoo use looming, it's no surprise that Kaepernick's agent got Andrian's permission before that commercial aired.
No, it's good for him, it's good for you, right? I'm like, yes and no, but he's not understanding my point of view, you know? Like, I'm supposed to be in that commercial, you know what I mean? It's my work that they're showing, you know?
Nez Andrian told me he had mixed feelings about signing the waiver, and he says he hasn't received any money in return for signing. But he says working with Kaepernick has been a good thing for him overall. And once Kaepernick and his agents had the rights to the tattoos on his body, he was free to extend those to Madden. So if you're planning to pick up a copy of the newest Madden next week, try this out. Pick the 49ers as your team, send your quarterback in for a rushing touchdown, and watch as the computerized Kaepernick gives that signature bicep kiss to the Nez Andrian tattoo faithfully recreated on his digital arm. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Tess Vigeland. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. If this is the way you remember pianist and songwriter Bruce Hornsby, well, you've missed a lot. Since his hit-making days of the 1980s, Hornsby toured for years with the Grateful Dead. He's gone bluegrass with Ricky Skaggs. He's played jazz with Wayne Shorter and Charlie Hayden. And now, on his new double album called Solo Concerts, Bruce Hornsby is experimenting with 20th century classical compositions. For this new live album, Bruce Hornsby's written a lovely set of liner notes. You remember those, right? And he opens with this: dedicating oneself to the pursuit of the unattainable is a beautiful way to live a life.
Let's just take the study of the piano. You could spend two lifetimes and not deal with the totality of the literature that's been written for the piano. And I started at age 17, junior year of high school. So I got a really late start. Certainly in the classical world, they say if you haven't started by, say, age 7 or so, then forget trying to be a classical pianist, a virtuoso who makes his living playing concerts. That's one area where this is clearly the pursuit of the unattainable for me, because I'm interested in virtuosity on the piano, and I try to deal with it on an intense level. But that is totally an unattainable area for me.
Well, given that you started at 17, I have to say there is virtuosity on display here. I mean, I'm a pianist myself. This album presents a very different way to listen to some of your music, very much through the lens of 20th century classical composition. I wonder what it was about those composers that attracted you. Schoenberg, for one, as opposed to, say, Chopin or Bach?
Okay, well, when I was at Berklee College of Music, you could go to the Boston Public Library and borrow records like you would borrow books. For some reason, I was drawn to the 20th century music. Charles Ives was a huge favorite of mine, and still is. In fact, I almost got sued. One of my first singles, Every Little Kiss, had an intro that was a sort of an homage to Ives. It was basically paraphrasing the beginning of the third movement of his Concord Sonata. It's called the Alcott. But fast forward, what really got me deeply involved in it, okay, in 2003, I signed with Columbia Records. I'd been at RCA for 18 years, and one of the greatest aspects of being a Columbia recording artist is they allow you to raid their vault. So I had them send me 176, 177 CDs.
Whoa.
And I filled in a lot of areas in the classical area that I had been interested in but had not really dealt with, because it's so vast. I got most of the Glenn Gould catalog. And I realized that he was not really into romantic music. He really loved the rigor and, I don't know, just sort of Spartan aesthetic of Bach and modern music. And I think maybe he thought that they were kindred spirits. And I sort of felt at that point in my career that I felt the same way. And so I started working on certain pieces that moved me. It just broadened my horizons.
Let's take an example here of how you've kind of incorporated all these different parts of your own musicality. And you segue from this boogie-woogie piece of yours called Preacher in the Ring. About the snake and-
watch them all sing as they go ten round with the preacher in the rain.
To a couple of compositions, one by Webern and this wild piece by Elliot Carter. What do you want us to hear? What are you saying here?
I guess what I'm saying is that this music that I've been so interested in for a good number of years now allows for a greater depth and variety of expression. And so if I'm singing a song that I've written about the snake-handling congregations of Appalachia, and it's sort of a bluesy boogie piece, like as you mentioned, I could just play the standard sort of blues-based music in the right hand if I'm soloing over it. But I feel like that's a little straight and a little kind of goes down a little too easy. So I use that as an excuse to put these pieces, the Webern piece, which is very pointillistic, and the Carter piece, which is atonal and sort of a perpetual motion piece, they feel to me like they're evocative of the lyrics, evocative of the scene that I'm painting with the words.
So when you strut out on stage in front of a crowd that fell in love with your work...
When I strut out, yeah.
Yeah, well, you strut, my, I would hope.
With my Elton John costume, with my... Yeah, that's really me.
They're not necessarily expecting to hear an atonal piano piece. I wonder, do you talk to them about the set? Or do you talk to them about what to listen for as you're playing?
I do. I talk to them... But here's the deal. These are sort of tried and true for me. I've been playing these pieces for the past couple of years in my solo concerts. Mm-hmm. Sure, there are some people there who are there for a nostalgic reason, and I try to be nice to them, and every few songs play one of those songs. But there's a very sizable contingent of people there who wish I would never play those songs.
Mm.
So frankly, it makes it so I get sort of yelled at by both factions. I just catch it from all sides. But that's fine. It's my lot in life because I've continued to move on and I haven't stayed the same. And that's to me is the way a musical life should be. Keep on pushing, keep on evolving and changing.
That's Bruce Hornsby. His latest album is called Solo Concerts. It comes out on Tuesday. Mr. Hornsby, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
She came back around like nothing really happened. Left him standing on Old Valley Road.
Every now and again, we hear about people who have lived through remarkable times in our history. 91-year-old Bob Motley of Kansas City, Missouri, is certainly one of them. His is a story of a black man in love with baseball. Now, racial integration didn't come for major league ballplayers until 1947, but it was another 19 years before a black man, Emmett Ashford, appeared behind home plate. In the interim, black umpires called balls and strikes in the Negro League. And Bob Motley is that league's last surviving ump. Motley also served with the first ever Black Marine Regiment in World War II, the Montford Point Marines, and his umpiring career began as he recovered from a gunshot wound at a military hospital on Okinawa.
I could look out the window and see there was a ball field, so I said I hopped on with my crutches, and they need an umpire. So I said, if you don't mind, I call balls and strike. They gave me a mask, and I got one of the breast protectors, and I started calling ball and strike.
Right. So you were eventually discharged with a Purple Heart.
Yes.
Thank you for your service.
Well, thank you.
Then in Kansas City, I was told that you lived two blocks from the old stadium there, and you wandered over and asked if they needed an umpire, and what'd they say?
Well, I went to the stadium and talked to the umpire crew, and chief umpire at that time, he said, "Kids, you don't know nothing about umpiring." And I said, I umpire in the Marine Corps. Please let me umpire. He said, "Well, get out of here." Next Sunday, the team came back to town, and here I was again pleading to him. So Finally, they let me umpire third base. The president of the league was there. He said, you did a good job. I'm going to give you $5. And he said, go and get your gear ready. Call me tomorrow, and I want you to start traveling in the league. He said, one thing about it, you have to ride on the bus with the ball player.
What was it like being with all those names that we all know so well from baseball history? What was it like being around them?
To me, it was just another ball player.
Yeah.
Whitey May, Hank Aaron, Satchel Paige. I didn't know at that time they was that good.
Bob Motley, we have a photo of you at umpiring school in Daytona Beach. What sent you there? Because that was about a decade into your umpiring career, wasn't it?
To honor way to go to the major league, you have to go to an umpire school. And it took me 10 years to go to an umpire school because the only school they had at that time was in the state of Florida. State of Florida had a state law that white couldn't teach black. Finally, they left that law, and I was the first black to go to umpire school.
So you graduated top of your class, and yet Major League Baseball still would not let you in.
Yeah. The only time I got called to the Major League umpire, they went on a strike. And
right.
They want me to come across the picket line. And I asked them, would I have a job after the strike is over with? And they say, we will let you know at that time. I say, I'm letting you know right now, I'm not crossing the picket line there.
So your first offer to umpire in the majors is during a strike. And was that your last opportunity?
That's when I said I wasn't going to try no more.
Yeah. You were born in a tiny town outside Selma, Alabama, in 1923. Can you give us a sense of what it was like to go from that childhood to become now the last living umpire from the Negro Leagues?
Well, when you're young like that, you don't realize life. Back in those days, Ku Klux Klan was pretty heavy in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen a lot of stuff happen. And I'm glad I left because I wouldn't be talking to you today.
Bob Motley has been speaking with us from his home in Kansas City, Missouri, where he holds the title of last living umpire from baseball's Negro Leagues at age 91. Sir, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
I appreciate you letting me talk to you.
Now, it's unlikely that watching one of those shows would prompt you to give up electricity and maybe exchange your car for a horse and buggy. But a new study shows another form of reality show can actually affect your behavior after you watch it.
You just brought home Alex. Did you hook up with him tonight? Probably. Do I care? No.
And
doesn't matter
this
to me.
Is why nobody likes you, because
doesn't
they keep
matter.
Talking.
Well, guess what? All that yelling can make you more aggressive. Brian Gibson studies psychology at Central Michigan University. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What did you set out to test in this study?
Well, we knew from past research that people who see relational aggression in media tend to become more angry. And, of course, relational aggression, gossiping and nastiness is prevalent on these shows. So we wanted to find out if it really would affect how aggressive people were after they watched.
You're dancing with another girl. No.
How did you choose which shows you were going to use in the study?
Well, it wasn't very scientific, to be honest with you. We just knew of Jersey Shore, and of course it was one of the most popular reality shows. Real Housewives is another popular franchise that has similar kinds of behaviors.
Move away, you already have your drama tonight. Move away.
I don't want her to be bullied, okay?
And then for control episodes, we picked shows that were surveillance reality shows, but that had more positive messages, things like Little People, Big World.
All right, so you ask people to watch an episode of either a reality show like Jersey Shore with lots of verbal aggression. And then I know you also had some watch a violent drama like CSI with lots of murder. Then what?
Well, then we, under the guise of a separate study, they had a chance to play a reaction time game. They believed that they were trying to hit a keyboard key as fast as they could to beat another opponent who was in another room, and they got to blast those people with noise if they won that reaction time game. So we monitored how long they wanted to blast them and how loud they wanted to make the noise when they blasted their opponent. It turns out that those who had watched Jersey Shore or Real Housewives actually gave louder, longer blasts after watching those shows than the people who watched the more violent crime dramas.
Oh my goodness. Why do you think you saw this result?
Well, watching these kinds of shows and seeing people engage in this nasty behavior, people are more likely to think aggressive thoughts after seeing those things. And so then when they have an opportunity to apply those, they do.
Brian, what use is a finding like this then? You know, should parents be taking notes, spouses?
I think that's exactly the message. Obviously, we're not advocating for some kind of censorship or pulling these things off the air. But I think parents in particular should pay attention to the kind of media that their children are consuming. And this is one form of media that may appear harmless, but I think our research provides a little bit of evidence that there can be some negative outcomes as well.
Brian Gibson studies psychology at Central Michigan University. His most recent study found that reality TV shows like Jersey Shore and Real Housewives make the people who watch them much more aggressive. I'm glad I didn't watch those, so I can very politely say thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Tess.
Before Co Booth became a writer, she was a caseworker with Child Protective Services in New York City, working with teenagers and families in crisis.
So I was the one who would remove children, unfortunately, and take them to foster homes. Mm. And a lot of times the foster parents would have children of their own. So I was always wondering, what would it be like for those kids to have these new kids come and leave and come and leave and not want to attach to them?
Co Booth's new book, Kinda Like Brothers, explores that question. It's a novel written for middle grade readers. It starts with the arrival of a new set of foster children in the home of 11-year-old Jarrett. He's been through this before many times, but always with babies. This time is a little different. A young girl named Treasure is brought to the house late one night, along with her 12-year-old brother, Kevon.
It's really hard for Jarrett to share his room with this kid who he, you know, views as a stranger. And all of a sudden, he's supposed to be like a brother to this guy. And it's really hard for him, especially Kevon, who is so much better at everything than Jarrett is. He's so much cooler, and it just drives my character crazy.
It certainly does. The parents in this story, the foster parent here, the mother, is in a strained relationship involving a lot of yelling, frustration. And of course, Jarrett, you know, feels like she loves all these foster babies more than she loves him. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to read from chapter 37 near the end of the book where he expresses this to her in no uncertain terms.
Sometimes I feel like you care more about the babies than me. I mean, maybe when I was little, you loved me more, but now you don't even have time for me. They come first all the time. Mom gasped. Is that the way you really feel? She was looking at me like it was the first time she ever saw me. I'm sorry, I mumbled real fast. I didn't mean to. I shouldn't have said anything. No, no. Mom wiped the tears from her cheek. I'm the one who should be sorry. I know it's hard for you, all these babies around all the time, but they need me, and I don't know, maybe I need them too.
Co Booth, reading from her new novel, Kinda Like Brothers. I wonder, how did you get inside the head of young boys? And I know you've done it in previous books, but I imagine that would be a challenge for anyone of the fairer sex.
Right?
You know, what did you do to make sure this rang true?
I think in every grown woman, there is an 11-year-old boy. No, I'm just joking. I don't know. I have nephews that they don't know it, but I've been spying on them while I was writing this book. And a lot of my book is set in a community center,
right,
much like the community center my nieces and nephews go to. I would just hang out there for a little while. I was the creepy lady, like, writing notes as the kids were running around.
You have some advice that is weaved throughout this book from, you know, men at the center to some of the younger boys, even about how to deal with police,
right,
that they have interactions with. Can you just review for us a little bit about that scene in the book?
Well, the scene in the book begins with Jared kind of walking up and seeing a counselor at the center getting stopped and frisked for no reason. Mm-hmm. And it really disturbs him. He's just really angry. That afternoon, a guy comes over to the center and he conducts man group where the boys get to ask questions. And of course, the stop and frisk comes up. And he just tells them, he's like, I'm going to keep it real with you guys. You black and Latino boys are going to get stopped a lot. And it doesn't matter what you do or what you didn't do. It's just because of who you are. And in the meantime, I need to teach you what to do when the cops stop you, not if, when they stop you. And so they kind of run through drills. He's telling them what to say and what not to do, and so that they don't get hurt or get shot. Even Jared, at the end of that scene, realizes that what the guy is teaching them is really important and that this is not a joke.
You know, I have to tell you, in the environment we're in right at this moment, that rang very true to me.
When I see the situation that's going on in Ferguson, it does remind me of the scene in the book, because I think any parent or anybody who is dealing with young black boys, as is what's happening in the community center in this book, mm-hmm. I think every single community center has had this conversation with their boys. And it's just so sad that we have to do this, but we do. And I hope that changes. I don't know if what's going on in Ferguson will change that, but I do hope it's at least continues the conversation, because it's just, it's exhausting, you know, that this is still going on in 2014.
What are you hoping this novel brings to your readers' lives? You know, this is a book about a very particular population. Who are you trying to reach?
Everybody. But particularly, I want kids who see themselves in this book, because it's so hard to find books that are for them and about them. It's not a fairy tale. It's a reality. Right. And it's, you know, it's complicated. But I hope it's true.
Ko Booth is the author of Kinda Like Brothers, which will appear on bookshelves this coming Tuesday. Ko, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
For the week ending August 24th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. That was the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajak, Becky Hersher, Stephen Jackson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Tess Vigeland, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.